Hello and welcome. It's a fantastic Easter Sunday and it's so nice to be talking to everybody at the Racecourse and Shoreham and Hove and here at New England in one day. Happy Easter. What an amazing celebration Easter is. We get to give glory to God and remember the most important day in history when Jesus Christ rose from the tomb. And the way I'm going to do it today is by reading to you from the Bible, a part of the Bible that we don't read that often because it's a slightly odd book. The Bible is a book of books. That's what the word Bible means. It means it's made up of lots of books. One of them, about halfway through the Bible, is called Ecclesiastes. It's really the kind of observations of a man who gets called the preacher, the teacher, and it's all his kinds of ideas and thoughts all put together in a few chapters. And I'm going to read to you from Ecclesiastes chapter 3, and I'm just going to read the first 14 verses, and then we will get into it. It says this, "For everything there is a season and a time for every matter under heaven, a time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to pluck up what is planted, a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to break down and a time to build up, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance, a time to cast away stones and a time to gather stones together, a time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing, a time to seek and a time to lose, a time to keep and a time to cast away, a time to tear and a time to sow, a time to keep silence and a time to speak, a time to love and a time to hate, a time for war and a time for peace. What gain has the worker from his toil? I've seen the business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. He's made everything beautiful in its time. And also he has put eternity into man's heart, yet so that he cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. I perceived that there is nothing better for them than to be joyful and to do good as long as they live. Also that everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in all his toil. This is God's gift to man. I perceive that whatever God does endures forever. Nothing can be added to it, nor anything taken from it. God has done it so that people should fear before him." I occasionally watch films with my children, and I remember watching a film once where the hero died about halfway through the story. And one of my sons, I guess he was probably about 4 or 5 at the time, turned around to me and said, "This is a stupid film." And that's the kind of reaction that a young child will have from moments of darkness and sorrow in the middle of a story that they might have expected to end happily. They revolt against the dark moment, the sad moment. It seems wrong. Even the word he used was quite revealing. Stupid. This is a stupid film. It's as though, you know, the scriptwriter got it wrong. This isn't right. This shouldn't happen. This isn't right. The film's wrong. What's happened to the film? Change the film. I think that's how children react, because they haven't perhaps hit that point in life, I guess most children, hopefully, where they've been exposed to the shocking horrors of life, the sorrows of life, the griefs and pains that can actually make us perhaps more jaded, more cynical. And things that we get used to through life can cause us to stop and consider less and less often how wrong the world seems, really. I remember the first time I watched a tragic film with a tragic ending, and I thought there'd been some mistake. I remember that feeling as a child. This isn't a child writing this, though. This is somebody at a late stage in his life, the preacher, as he's called in this book. He's talking about life's experiences, a whole mixture of experiences, and he's describing them in a whole range, a time for this, a time for that, a time for the other. We may have recognized these words as I was reading them to you as like a poem, and maybe even a happy descriptive poem of the kind of rich mixture of life. Frankly, that's not quite what this is meant to be as he's writing it. It's a little bit darker, actually, because he's kind of saying at the very end of it, "What gain has the worker from his toil?" he says in verse 9. What gain? What's the point? What's the purpose? What's the meaning? If these things just happen, there's a time for this, there's a time for that, time to live, a time to die, time to dance, time to mourn. Very well, but where's it all going? What's the point of it? If these are the pieces of the story, who's telling the story? Where's the story going? What's the ending? What's the meaning? What's the purpose? What is the hope? Is there any hope? I don't think that we do very well without hope as human beings. I think it seems to me that there's something within us that wants life to mean something, wants our individual lives and really wants the whole world to mean something. And that's either some kind of quirk of our biology, or it's there because we're not just animals. You know, animals generally, they can live without craving meaning. You don't see a lot of cattle sitting around discussing existence. I don't think animals necessarily deal with that kind of wisdom. Maybe owls do, you know. Owls always look a bit wise. Although I went to a zoo once, and the owl's keeper said that owls were pretty stupid, actually. They've got tiny brains. But you know, they look like they're onto something. But generally, animals, they don't really get it. They don't ask those questions that even children ask. Where's this going? How's it going to end? Is there hope in this story? Or the other kinds of questions kids ask, where they sort, what for? You know, they're not watching a film, but they'll say, why are you doing this? And you say, well, I'm just putting my shirt on to go to work. Why? Oh, well, I go to work so that I can pay the bills and keep you kids fed and clothed. And why? Well, because I love you. Why? And you think, I'm not sure anymore. But they keep asking, why, what for, what for? They want to know, and it's part of human nature to be inquisitive. And actually, if we're honest, if you can keep doing the what for, can't you? You can keep following that trail. What for, what for, what for? And it can be like that thread that you pull on a jumper. You keep pulling it long enough, the jumper's gone. Because we don't necessarily know what for. Left to ourselves, we can't really see a big fat meaning to the world. People that try to find it often end up very depressed. Lots of philosophy students kill themselves because there seems to be no real answers out there. And that's actually the very flavor of this book in the Bible, a book called Ecclesiastes. It's somebody dealing with all these questions of meaning and hope. He has a word, a favorite word, vanity. Vapor. Sometimes the Bible translators they put it as vapor, like mist on a mirror, on a glass. When you breathe on it, it's like mist. It just stays there for a few seconds before it disappears. He says that's what life's like. It's pretend meaning. There's no ultimate meaning. It doesn't stay. And we as human beings we can't really cope without meaning. We long for life to mean something. Yeah, maybe it's all an accident. Maybe we just emerged from the slime. We just kind of randomly became monkeys, and then the monkeys randomly became humans. But surely there must be more to life. There must be some meaning to it. I can't handle the thought that it's all just sheer accident. And I suspect the reason we can't handle that is because really that it isn't true. That there really is a meaning. There really is supposed to be. There really is supposed to be purpose and hope. But we may have got to a point in our life where we question that. You ever got there? I remember getting there as a teenager, getting to the point in my life where I thought, what if there really isn't any meaning? What if it really is just a total accident? If nothing really means anything? It was a dark moment. There's a famous book by Tolstoy, Leo Tolstoy. It's one of his shorter books, and he wrote a book where he described what this was like for him. He was a pretty set-up man, a lot of money, a lot of connections. He was a powerful man. As a young man, he had a big estate, big family, very happy life. But he got to a crunch point where he hit this question himself. He describes it like this: I could give no reasonable meaning to any single action or to my whole life. I was only surprised that I could have avoided understanding this from the very beginning. It has been so long known to all, even to the writers of the Bible, like Ecclesiastes. Today or tomorrow, sickness and death will come. They had already come to those I love or to me. Nothing will remain but stench and worms. Sooner or later, my affairs, whatever they may be, will be forgotten and I shall not exist. Then why go on making any effort? How can man fail to see this? And how go on living? That is what is surprising. One can only live while one is intoxicated with life. As soon as one is sober, it's impossible not to see that it is all a mere fraud, and a stupid fraud. That's precisely what it is. There's nothing either amusing or witty about it. It's simply cruel and stupid. There's that word stupid again, just like my son with a sad film. It's just meaningless. It's just stupid. Maybe we try to construct a meaning. Maybe we try to fill our lives with meaning or distractions or anything to keep us preoccupied and entertained and amused enough to avoid the dark chasm of futility and vanity that this part of the Bible is being so dangerously honest about. But it doesn't really last, because we know even the meanings that we do construct in our lives or the entertainments that distract us, they don't last. Even the good, noble things that we give our lives to, the good causes, the kind of hashtag causes that we like to jump on the back of, the things that make us feel like we're important and we're helping in society. And maybe we are and we're doing good, but really even that, how long will it actually last? And what is it against the eternity of nothingness that the world seems to be genuinely going towards? Is that all there is? Well, this is why Easter is so important. And actually, this part of the Bible, in a strange way, kind of points to it. It talks about our search for meaning in chapter 3, verse 11, when it says, he has put eternity into man's heart so that he can't find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. We're kind of looking for answers. We can't help searching because there's something about humanity that wants to know. But he also says just before that in the same verse, he has made everything beautiful in its time. It's here that he's saying, yeah, these parts of life, a time to be born, a time to die, a time to plant, a time to pluck up what is planted, a time to kill, a time to heal, this long list that goes on and on. If there is a storyteller, if there is a planner, a designer, then these things that seem so random, they actually can be beautiful according to his plan. We don't see it yet. We don't understand it. We're on the wrong side. We have the wrong vantage point, the wrong perspective. But if we could see it from his side, we might admit, we might acknowledge and agree that God's plans are actually beautiful in their time. It takes a lot to believe that. Maybe in your life you're walking through a situation, or you've seen situations, or you just watch the news enough to realize and say, life doesn't seem to have any meaning. It seems to be going nowhere. It seems even very dark and miserable. I reckon that's exactly how it would have felt for anyone who was there on Good Friday, when the Son of God, this perfect, amazing person, Jesus Christ, the one who seemed to be full of answers and hope and wisdom, he was falsely tried, declared guilty of things he hadn't done, and taken away to be crucified. Mocked first, tortured, shamed, stripped naked. The most horrifying, horrifying of deaths to the most noble and righteous of people. Life seems so cruel and unfair sometimes. And at this time, perhaps at its cruelest and most unfair. It just seemed so dark. But the story wasn't yet over. The story wasn't complete. God makes everything beautiful in its time. In its time. Things that we see now as wrong, out of shape, all distorted, are not done yet. It's not complete yet. There may be a time when we'll look at it and see, look at what God was doing. Look at his wisdom. We can't understand it all now, and perhaps we won't be until he finishes the story. It's a little bit like the famous illustration that people like to make of a tapestry. If you stand one side of a tapestry, you know, you've seen these big, grand tapestries with loads of detail. They look incredible. They look fantastic sometimes. You can stand there for ages gaping at all the detail and the color and the intricacy of the design. It's staggering. But then you can stand on the other side of the tapestry and see no pattern whatsoever. It just looks like loose threads, random tangles and knots. No design, no pattern. It's just a mess on that side. Sometimes we might see a little faint pattern, but it doesn't seem consistent. It's just not right. Looks right, but no, it can't be right. The resurrection, if it's true, points to a God who is working a powerful tapestry together. It points to a God who knows what he's doing, even at the darkest points. A God who isn't thrown or phased or thwarted, foiled by the mess of our lives and the mess of the world's wrongdoing and injustice. He's in control, perfectly in control. And it points to the possibility that he's even working through the dark things that we go through now in this life. He has a plan to make things beautiful in their time. If that isn't true, then frankly, the story he's telling is sick. Some people think that, well, maybe Christianity, you know, really is just about Good Friday. It really is. It's just about Jesus giving his life, sacrificing his life. He didn't rise from the dead. He just gave his life as an act of sacrifice, as a kind of an example to show us how we should suffer, to show us how we should heroically lay our lives down before the wickedness and the injustice of the world. Now, that might, for some reason, sound noble to some people, but there isn't any hope there, obviously. There's no reason to hope there. There's no reason to find that message appealing or attractive. And the reality is that the masses of millions of people all around the world who are turning to Christianity, from China to South America to Africa to the Middle East, all over the world, people in greater numbers than ever are turning to Jesus Christ. The reason why is because the answers it offers are so much better than just random example of sacrifice. There is a hope that Jesus has invited us into through his death and resurrection. He's risen from the grave. He is victorious even over death. And because of that, there's hope for us. Now, obviously, it could be that people who follow Jesus end up suffering. But if Jesus hasn't raised, then it means their suffering is doubly awful. People these days are suffering for the Christian message more than any other time in history. More people a year these days die for being Christians than any other time in history. We just get to know the most famous examples. You may remember just recently images like this, very recent newspapers and stories across the world of these 21 in Egypt put to death by the Islamic State for their faith in Jesus Christ. The Apostle Paul says in 1 Corinthians chapter 15, if in this life only we have hope, we are of all people most to be pitied. If we're left to just being under the sun in this life, randomly watching the different things, different sufferings, different random events that happen and following Jesus, trying to be good Christians, laying our lives down, then really we deserve nothing but pity. But if Christ has raised from the dead truly, it gives a totally different perspective, even to our suffering and our waiting. It means that history has a reason. It's going somewhere. The story has a good ending. There's beauty in it. It means that life can have actual hope. Why? Because we're optimists? No, because Christ has raised from the dead. He's risen. And obviously, it means we should ask the question, did he really rise? If it's not true, if it's just a myth, then there's no reason why you should listen to any more of what the Bible has to say or what I'm saying. I'm just peddling another con. But could it be that he really did? The truth is that if Jesus didn't rise, we have some huge explaining to do. The letters of the New Testament, like 1 Corinthians, for example, talk about the resurrection of Jesus. In 1 Corinthians, the writer of that letter, Paul, who was writing only about 20 years after the crucifixion, talks about Jesus being seen as raised from the dead by 500 witnesses on one occasion. 500. Now, he's writing literally a short 20 years after the events he's describing. Now, we might have always assumed, well, the resurrection just got made up and exaggerated. It was just Chinese whispers. You know, people wanted to believe it, so they made it up, and then other people did believe it. That isn't in the slightest bit how it worked. The fact is that Jewish people started to worship Jesus as God within a very, very short time of Jesus' death. Jewish people would definitely not worship a human being as God unless they had given a very, very good reason. They would never do that. Their beliefs about God, their fear, respect for God, even the name of God, they couldn't even write his name fully, the Orthodox Jews. And yet, within a few years of Jesus' death, they're publicly writing letters referring to Jesus as God. They're convinced he's risen. 500 witnesses. That's a strong claim to make if you're making it up. The historians of today, secular New Testament scholars who aren't Christians, will say we still have to explain the fact that there was an empty tomb on Easter Sunday, that there were disciples who claimed to see the risen Jesus Christ, that there were 12 disciples who went to their deaths proclaiming the resurrection of Jesus Christ. These were people who were claiming that Jesus rose and that they had seen him as risen. And instead of recanting, instead of saying, okay, I made it up, it's not true, at the point of death, they were killed for their faith. They believed and preached the resurrection even to death. And many people through history have died for their religion, but not for something that they knew that they'd made up. That doesn't make any sense. We might die for something because we passionately believe in it, even if it isn't right, but not when we actually know that we've made it up. We know it's a complete con. If you believe that Jesus didn't rise from the dead, you have to believe that this was the most powerfully constructed, carefully planned conspiracy that could possibly be imagined. That a whole group of people got together and planned to con the human race into believing that Jesus is God and rose from the dead. And then they died for their con. They died for it. And in the process, they began the religion that preached truth and honesty and peace and righteousness and love and justice and brought about millions of the good things that we enjoy in the world today. Listen, that doesn't make any sense. It makes far more sense to look at history and say there is a big hole in history that is only going to be filled by the true resurrection of the Son of God. It makes more sense, which is why quite a lot of people through history who've tried to disprove the resurrection of Jesus have actually become Christians while doing their research. I could name many people. Literally, I could think of several names right now, people who that's happened to. They've researched it, they've tried to disprove it, they've even planned to write books saying it didn't happen. While they're researching for their book, they become Christians because they realize they can't disprove it. They can't find a way to push the evidence back. It just makes more sense in the end to accept it must have happened. That's powerful. That's compelling. It's also compelling to find out that he's alive by talking to him, praying to him, and finding out that he reaches out to you, that he's alive from there, that he can actually deal with you, he can meet with you, he can do things in your life. That's what I've found out. That's what we found out. We found out that as we've pursued him, as we've gone after him, as we've got to know him, he's turned out to be real. He's turned out to do extraordinary things in our lives that couldn't be explained. This is God, risen from the dead. It means that life has meaning. It means that life has a story. It means that craving that we have for there to be purpose is going to get fulfilled. Let me illustrate it with a story from Mozart, the composer. When he was young, he used to come home from being out with his friends in living with his father. I guess this was in Vienna or somewhere in Austria. He would get home late, and he would stumble into the house and walk up to the piano on the ground floor and open the lid, and he would just start playing a scale. And he would just leave it. And then he would just wait. And his dad, who was supposed to be asleep upstairs in his bed, would just sort of, stir, get out of bed, start putting on his dressing gown and slippers, come down the stairs cursing and swearing, angry with his son. He'd finally push him away from the piano stool, sit down himself, and finish the scale. It's such a perfect illustration of this human need for closure, for the story to end. It can't be right that history just means nothing, that it just leads us on with this feeling that life's going somewhere, that the world is so beautiful and so charming, and we so enjoy life, don't we? We enjoy so many of the good things, but they're kind of stuck halfway through. We just die, and then it's all over, and it doesn't really mean anything. Is that what life's supposed to be like? Well, the answer is no. The answer is no. The answer is that God wants life to be beautiful, everything to be beautiful in its time. The reason why it doesn't seem beautiful is our fault, because we have messed up his creation, his world, with our wrongdoing, with our shame, with our departure from the plan. But God is so committed to changing things, to dealing with the sin. It's a little bit like this. Think about it like this. Sin is like a huge battleship that's fighting against us. We've created it through our wrongdoing, our evil. The wickedness that is in the human heart has given birth to, created this great big warship that's constantly pounding us with artillery. In Jesus' perfect life, terrible death, and glorious resurrection, a great torpedo has hit this enemy battleship under the water. Now, if you've seen the war movies with the battleships and submarines, you know how it works. A ship can be hit for a long time before it goes down. It can sometimes take hours. And even after the torpedo has hit the boat, there can still be a lot of fighting, maybe even more fighting. It gets tougher. It gets more brutal. The battle rises. It gets worse. But you still know that battleship is going down. It's been sunk, really. The torpedo has hit underwater. That's Christianity. Jesus, through his death and resurrection, he sent a torpedo and he struck the power of death. He struck the power of sin and injustice, sickness, evil. He dealt with it finally. He came from the grave victorious. He has won. Now, we don't yet see that boat going underwater. We still see the world in a mess. Maybe we even see our own personal lives in some mess. But there is someone who has defeated the mess. And by getting to know him and coming into relationship with him, we can be confident that life has meaning, life has story, life has purpose and dignity. And because it has because of Jesus' resurrection, this vanity that this preacher is talking about, that the sense that life is just vain, it's just meaningless, is dealt with. Because Christ is raised. Even the things that we do, he says in verses 12 and 13, he says, I perceive that there is nothing better for them than to be joyful and to do good as long as they live. Also that everyone should eat and drink and take pleasure in all his toil. This is God's gift to man. God blesses the world by giving us things that we can enjoy, and yet the enjoyment we can have is not just doubled, it's like multiplied by infinity if we know that it's going somewhere. It's got purpose, it's got meaning. That's why Paul says at the end of his massive chapter in the New Testament about the resurrection of Jesus Christ in 1 Corinthians and chapter 15, verse 58,
where he says, "Therefore, my beloved brothers, be steadfast, immovable, always abounding in the work of the Lord, knowing in the Lord your labor is not in vain." It's like he's saying the battleship is going down. It's going to go down. That boat, that enemy boat is going down. Stand firm. Your labor is not in vain. The jobs you do, the work you do, the love you show, the kindness you show, the way you're loving your neighbor, the way you're serving the poor, the way you're giving your heart to other people, the way you're building the church, the way that you're loving your husband or wife, loving your kids, the stuff you're doing at your 9-to-5, the work you're doing for the Lord Jesus Christ as though no one else was watching, but only Jesus was watching. It's not in vain. It's not meaningless. It's not stupid. It's not hopeless. It's not a sad story with a bad ending. There's a meaning to it. There's a purpose. The scale will be complete. God's building an incredible tapestry. One day we'll see it properly. And while we're waiting in this present age, we can have dignity because of that. A friend of mine told a story of some friends he had who'd been overseas in a situation in a developing world country, serving the poor. They'd spent their lives doing it. They gave themselves wholeheartedly in this other country, quietly, humbly serving the poor. They flew home to their native country in the Western world, to a comfortable, affluent world. And this is at the very end of their lives. They kind of got way past retirement age. They flew home. They arrived at the airport in their native country. And the door of the plane opened. And there were some celebrities that were getting off the plane at another end. And there was this huge welcome party for them, these celebrities. Massive welcome party. And this guy who poured out his life for the poor in another country, he got home and there was no one to meet him at all. No one to meet him. No welcome at all. And he said in his heart, "This isn't fair." And it felt like God says straight back to him, "You're not home yet." See, if Jesus has been raised from the dead and he is planning an ending to the story that will show him as having been making everything beautiful in its time, it means that we're not at the end of the story. When we hit those times, we think, well, no one's thanking me. No one's noticing me. I'm not being received. There's no gratitude being shown to me. Wow, we hit those times. I know those feelings, those moments where you just feel, well, where's the thanks? Where's the gratitude? Where's the recognition? Listen, you're not home yet. Be patient in the midst of the waiting for God's beautiful story, beautiful tapestry to be revealed. It means that we can expect his power to be at work. If the ship of evil has been hit, if there's a torpedo that's hit the mark, we can expect some progress in the fight against sickness, in the fight against injustice. We can pray for the sick and expect to see the power of the resurrection unleashed in people's lives. Some of the stories I've heard literally in the last few days about dramatic healings in this church have taken my breath away. I mean, I'd love to tell you some of the stories in detail. We want to show you through some videos that we'll be showing more and more as we get better at that as a church, telling you some of the stories of powerful healings in people's lives as we pray, as we try to deal with injustice. We don't have to think, well, it's just us against the world. No, Jesus is risen. The power of his kingdom is now at work. The evil ship is going down. We can expect to see breakthrough in tough situations. We can expect to see systems of wickedness defeated. We can expect to see change when it comes to big problem issues in our society, human trafficking, gang violence, all kinds of injustice on the basis of economic and racial differences. We don't have to assume that nothing will change. We can expect Jesus, the risen King, to gradually and powerfully bring more and more to bear in the world in which we live now. And we can expect to meet him, to know him, to have him involved in our lives. If Jesus has risen, he's risen as a person who loves his people with real love, filled with desire, filled with compassion for them, wanting to have a relationship with them. Jesus said to his disciples at the Last Supper, he says, I'll depart from you, but I will come to you. I'll come to live alongside you. I will be with you by my Holy Spirit. That means that following Jesus is not following an idea or a set of good behaviors. It's not even just waiting for him to appear from heaven, although it is that. It's knowing him in the here and now, experiencing him in the day to day. I don't just believe Jesus rose from the dead because there's an empty tomb on Easter Sunday. I believe Jesus rose from the dead because I meet with him so often. He does answer my prayers. He does do extraordinary things. He does speak into my life. He's taking me on a journey. He's taking this church on a journey. He's involved in the thick of our lives because he's risen. And we who are looking towards him, facing him, if you like, our faces begin to shine more and more. You imagine when the night is nearly over and the sun is rising, if you're walking away from the sun and you see people walking in the opposite direction towards the sun, their faces are kind of shining pink if it's a bright morning sun. There's something powerful on their faces. Your face isn't shining and yet theirs is because they're facing this upcoming light. That's exactly what Christians can be. If they're facing Jesus, if you are facing the risen Jesus Christ, your face will shine more and more brightly because you'll see, you'll be a reflection of his powerful light, even if others are walking the other way. You maybe yourself haven't ever understood that you could have an actual relationship with this person. It's only possible because of what he's done for us. Yeah, we are the ones that make the world seem dark, sad, meaningless. It's because of the evil that's in the human heart. And you've got that in your own life. There are things that you know you shouldn't have done, shouldn't have said, shouldn't have thought, but you did. Or things that you should have done, should have said, should have thought, but you didn't. And it's because of our shame, our sin, our evil, the world is so out of whack. But Jesus Christ, through his death and resurrection, has dealt with the power of evil, even what's in our own hearts. You can come to know him today. You can know him yourself like we have come to know him, experiencing his light in your life, being transformed. Let that be your story this Easter. Come to know the person who's planning all things and who will make everything beautiful in its time.